Record will indicate all the jurors are present, counsel, and the parties present. Ms. Kearns, you ready to proceed at this time?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, members of the jury. Well, I have to tell you, I felt at times during Mr. Pantone's opening like I have the hardest job in the world. Sitting there listening to things being said about my client, which I believe the evidence is going to show to be absolutely not true. And then I realized my client actually had the harder job of it, much more so than I. As I mentioned earlier in the case, my name is Jennifer Kearns, and it's my privilege to represent Illumina. Also, my co-counsel, Nikki Espinoza, is a former law partner of mine. A few years ago, she elected to leave the law firm and become vice president of intellectual property at Illumina, so she'll be working throughout this case to present Illumina's case. In the opening, you've heard from Mr. Pantone the various theories that Dr. Zarnik holds relating to his employment at Illumina. Mr. Pantone gave you a preview of Dr. Zarnik's view of the case. As every one of us knows, there are two sides to every story. I'm going to go ahead and ask that we put up our first board of the chronology. I'm not going to discuss it at this moment, but I wanted to make sure that we have it up here so that when I do, I'm going to have it on the overhead and also here on the board so everyone can read it very clearly. Now, as the plaintiff in this action, Dr. Zarnik has the burden of proof. And when you are finally instructed at the close of the case, one of the things that Judge Prager will tell you about is what the burden of proof is and what the standard is. Illumina does not have the burden to convince you that he's wrong. Rather, he has the burden to convince you that he's right. Illumina actually does not have the burden to put on evidence to dispute whatever it is that Dr. Zarnik is going to put before you. The fact is, we will be putting on quite a bit of evidence to dispute the theories that Dr. Zarnik has advanced and is offering up to you as explanations for what happened. But it's important to remember at all times that it's Dr. Zarnik who bears this burden. A preponderance of the evidence is something you will be instructed on, but in lay terms, it means tipping the scale. It means convincing you that Dr. Zarnik's theory is more likely true than not. And if it's a draw, if you were to conclude on one theory or all three theories that it's equally balanced, you'll be instructed that you have to rule against Dr. Zarnik and in favor of Illumina, because Dr. Zarnik is the person who has the burden. Now, in this case, we have the three different theories that have been mentioned by Mr. Pantone, and as I said, Dr. Zarnik bears the burden on each and every one of those. Because he is the plaintiff, Dr. Zarnik gets to go first, which is why I and my clients had to sit and listen to an opening, chafing at the bit, I admit, to respond to some of those statements. As the judge has already instructed you, it's very important to wait until all the evidence is in before forming any conclusion, final impression, or decision. And as Judge Prager told you, our best estimate of the duration of the trial is about 3 weeks. We're going to try to bring it in a little under 3 weeks. We all know there's that holiday weekend approaching, but our best estimate at this time is that we're all going to be engaged in this process for about 3 weeks. So my request to each of you, and certainly the court's instruction, is to keep an open mind throughout the process. Keep an open mind until all evidence is in. Because we don't get to put our evidence on until Mr. Pantone has put everything he wants to put on into the case. Now, let me go into a discussion about Illumina's perspective. It's important to hear this perspective because, as you've heard in the course of Mr. Pantone's opening, there's a lot going on in this case. There are a lot of events, a lot of timeline events, and there is a better explanation, in our view, for what happened and what occurred at Illumina. Now, we've all heard the phrase, trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, and that well-known phrase is something that describes Dr. Zarnik's relationship with Illumina to a T. Now, Mr. Pantone mentioned Dr. Zarnik as a world-famous scientist in chemistry, and I don't dispute that. What I will say is that Illumina is not a company that is focused solely in his area of expertise. Dr. Mark Chi, one of the other scientific founders, is also a world-famous scientist, highly renowned, highly respected. And when Illumina came to be formed, it was formed from nothing, as I said. It was a startup. Now, Dr. Zarnik is somebody, the evidence is going to show, who had a history and work history of working in the area of combinatorial chemistry and fluorescence, and he had generally been in roles that required a great deal of scientific expertise. Dr. Zarnik was first identified, as were several other people, by some of the investors who were thinking of forming a company around a technology. Let me say a couple of words just about how Illumina even came to be formed. Dr. John Stulpnagel, who is with me today, is one of the founders of Illumina. Dr. Stulpnagel was at the time working in a company called CW Group. This was a group that identifies opportunities to develop companies and then analyzes the technology, decides whether the technology is good enough to form a company around it. And then if they go forward, they look to raise money to get the company off and running. They look to identify and hire management personnel to run this new company. And that's what Dr. Stulpnagel was doing. It is Dr. Stulpnagel who identified or found the technology that ultimately Illumina came to be based upon. Dr. Stulpnagel and his colleague at CW Group, Larry Bach, took a look at the technology, evaluated it, and thought it looked pretty good, but they didn't rest upon their own opinions. What they saw was a need to find other people knowledgeable in the field, solicit their opinions on whether this technology really was as good as we think it is, before we go off and raise money and start a company around the technology. And that's a process that took some time. And Dr. Zarnik was one of the people identified by Dr. Stulpnagel and Larry Bach, whose opinion they decided to solicit. Dr. Zarnik is not the only one they talked to by any means. They talked to a lot of different people and said, "What do you think of this technology? Does it look good? Should we start a company?" So after Dr. Stulpnagel identified the technology, he did seek Dr. Zarnik's input on the technology, as he had with others, and they started discussing not only the merits of the technology, but whether Dr. Zarnik might be interested in joining the company if the decision was made to go forward. And remember, the evidence is going to show you at the time they had this initial meeting, it was a breakfast meeting at Milton's in Del Mar. At the time this breakfast meeting occurred, the decision to form a company had not been reached. The whole process was one in which they were determining whether to form the company. And they did ask Dr. Zarnik, "What do you think of the technology? And if we decide to form a company, might you have an interest in being involved?" And he indicated that he might have an interest. Now, one of the things to remember with the startup companies is that they start out with some finite or limited amount of money, and it's usually called seed money, like sowing the seeds for your garden. But one of the first tasks that's really important for startup companies is to raise more money because your seed money will only go so far. When you run out of money, there's not much left to do. So raising money is very, very important in the early days. Let me tell you a little bit, though, about what Illumina's focus is. Illumina is a life sciences company. There are lots of different kinds of companies that are engaged in what we call life sciences. Pharmaceutical or drug development companies are in life sciences. Companies that make medical devices like pacemakers or blood serum measurement apparatus, those are also life sciences companies. And Illumina's focus is a little bit different. I'm going to try my best to put into understandable terms, because trust me, I'm not the expert in this area either, what it is that Illumina does. Now, Illumina has an amazing technology, and that's one of the reasons I asked in jury selection about people's reactions to hearing scientific evidence, because you're going to get, as jurors in this case, an insider's peek at some really amazing science that's going on at Illumina. And again, Illumina is still a young company, but the potential applications for some of this technology are pretty amazing. Now, we all have genetic differences in our makeup. We're all humans, we all have the same number of chromosomes, but there are some very slight differences in our genetic makeup, and some of those differences manifest or show themselves in differences in hair color, height, eye color. These differences, though, aren't really medically significant. It doesn't really matter if I have dark hair and somebody else has blonde hair. But the same genetic difference that can cause me to be dark-haired and dark-eyed and somebody else light-haired and light-eyed can also cause me to be susceptible to certain diseases and cause the other person to be very resistant to disease. The same genetic differences can cause me to respond very well to a certain medication and have somebody else respond not at all to the same medication. Today, medicine is still not an exact science. And for a number of diseases, the determination of what medication is going to work best for a given patient is still very hit and miss. Very often with a number of diseases, the patient has to go through trying medication A, and when that doesn't work, move on to medication B and then medication C, and it can be very frustrating for the patient and his or her family and the physicians. We're not there yet, but we're hoping that one day Illumina's technology might even be used in an application to develop some individualized or personalized medicine. Again, we're a long way off, but we're very hopeful that someday Illumina's technology may be part of a technology that enables doctors or scientists to look at somebody's genetic makeup and say, this person is at risk for developing these diseases. Let's watch them. And if they do develop a certain disease, we hope that the technology may someday enable us to say, given this person's genetic makeup, the first drug of choice to treat this should be drug A. If that doesn't work, the next best one is drug C. So that's where we're hoping to head. Now, you've heard the term public company. It's true that in the summer of 2000, Illumina, as we say, went public. Its stock became available for purchase on the NASDAQ. But prior to that time, it was a shoestring startup company. I think that we heard in jury selection a number of people have had family and friends who have worked in startups. We've all heard about the dot-com boom and then the dot-com doom. And so I think we all understand that startups, a lot of startups, fail. A lot of them fail because they don't raise enough money to keep going. A lot of them fail because they mismanaged the money they do have. But as I said before, you are going to hear evidence in this case that Illumina started up with seed money that would have been sufficient to keep it going for only a matter of months. And so raising additional capital was very, very critical. Now, the evidence in this case is going to show a couple of things. And some of these things are a little difficult for me to say, but I have to say them because they are the truth, and we believe the evidence is going to support them entirely. As intelligent and as well-known in his field as Dr. Zarnik may be, the evidence is going to show very clearly that from June of 1998, which is when Dr. Zarnik joined the company, he simply lacked the energy, the dedication, the drive, the work ethic that the other people who were at Illumina had at that time. You are going to hear evidence of the kinds of hours, the kinds of effort, the kinds of absolute dedication to this company that others were living and breathing day in and day out, often 7 days a week, week after week. And Dr. Zarnik did not possess that level of drive, dedication, and energy. Now, remember that Dr. Zarnik was the chief scientific officer when he came on board. And as the chief scientific officer, his role encompassed not only making contributions to the company's science, but he was supposed to be in a leadership role. Not just heading up a group of scientists, but developing scientific strategy, identifying opportunities and saying, you know, this is where I think we should focus our efforts, or this is an application that I think our science could be geared toward and could make us money. There were also a couple, at the very beginning, a couple of different scientific groups, notably chemistry, which was headed up by Dr. Zarnik, and molecular biology, which was headed up by Dr. Mark Chi. You'll meet Dr. Chi during the course of this trial. These two groups, you will see from some evidence in the case, needed to work very closely with one another because, frankly, each depended upon the other for various tasks to be done before they could move forward with what they needed to do. Dr. Zarnik, as the head and chief scientific officer of the entire scientific program, had the responsibility to develop a cohesive or good working relationship between these two groups. You're going to hear evidence of things Dr. Zarnik did that were very divisive, that pitted the groups against one another, and that created something of an us versus them environment between two peak scientific groups that had to work together. The evidence is also going to show that Dr. Zarnik, apart from having less drive, less energy, less dedication, had some very lazy tendencies. It will show he was a procrastinator, and people who are his friends, people who liked Dr. Zarnik and worked with Dr. Zarnik, are going to say that was unfortunately one of his faults. Dr. Zarnik is also going to be shown through the evidence as somebody who liked to delegate almost all of his work or his tasks to others. There's nothing wrong with that to a certain extent, but the evidence is going to show that Dr. Zarnik avoided any task or any assignment for which he would have personal responsibility, personal accountability. And in fact, the grant application, which Mr. Pantone referred to and which was due in April of 1999, that was the first assignment or task ever given to Dr. Zarnik where he had personal responsibility. He was the one person that the company was to look to say, do this and do it by a certain date. The evidence is also going to show that he had that assignment on his plate for some 5 months before he disclosed that he wouldn't finish it. Now I'm going to make a timeline of key events. I may look back at a certain point to this overhead, but we will be trying to duplicate it directly here on the board, which is a little bit closer to you. The first thing that happened on the timeline is in early April 1998, and this is, of course, after the introductory breakfast at Milton's. And on this date, Dr. Zarnik had not been offered employment with Illumina, although by this point in time, early April 1998, it had been determined that there was going to be a company forming around this technology. The technology looked good, and the decision to go forward had been made. In essence, you're going to see the communication and see that Dr. Zarnik is the one, the first one, who said, "I'd like to come work for the company, but here are my terms." And you will see in that letter that Dr. Zarnik was asking for some fairly unusual terms, some unreasonable terms, frankly, because the evidence is going to show that Dr. Zarnik didn't have any belief that he was coming to a big money, big company with a lot of perks. The evidence is going to show he understood he was coming to a startup that had a little bit of seed money and that would run out of money if it didn't raise more quickly. But Dr. Zarnik was proposing a number of unreasonable perks for himself, and you'll hear evidence that he agrees that some of these things that he was requesting for himself are things he'd never give somebody else if he was on the other side of the negotiating contract. The evidence is going to show that an offer was eventually made to Dr. Zarnik, although not on the very enriched terms that he was asking for, but an offer was eventually made by Dr. Stulpnagel. Dr. Zarnik accepted that offer, and he began work on June 15, 1998. Now, I'm going to try not to extend this opening too long by mentioning each and every point that Mr. Pantone raised, and frankly, I don't think I could dredge them all up at this point. One thing I do remember Mr. Pantone mentioning was Dr. Zarnik was the first employee to sign an offer letter with Illumina, meaning he was the first person to commit to going. You'll hear evidence and see evidence that refutes that. That is not true. There may have been a suggestion that Dr. Zarnik was the first person to actually show up and begin performing work at Illumina. You will hear evidence that will absolutely refute that as well. That is not true. Now, during the very early days, June 15, 1998, when Dr. Zarnik began, the company was being operated literally on a shoestring out of some spare offices that the venture investor CW Group had up in Cardiff, California. It was very tight quarters. You can see everyone coming and going out of this office suite. And during that period of time, the summer of 1998, the number one key task for the team was to develop a very good written business plan, because the written business plan is what the company shops around to investors and convinces them that we've got a good thing going here and it makes sense for you to invest money in us. During those first few months, it was expected and anticipated that all of the people who were on board at that early stage, and most importantly, the senior management, which consisted of Dr. Stulpnagel, Dr. Chi, and Dr. Zarnik, will all be putting full effort into developing this business plan. You are going to hear evidence that Dr. Zarnik made very few contributions to the development of this business plan, either in contribution of ideas or in actually writing portions of the plan. In fact, the evidence is going to show he didn't write any portion of the plan until Dr. Stulpnagel specifically assigned a couple of sections to him, and that other persons who weren't even in management had voluntarily drafted portions and submitted content for inclusion in the plan. The evidence is going to show that by August of 1998, just 2 months into Dr. Zarnik's employment, 2 months into Dr. Chi's employment, Dr. Stulpnagel and Dr. Chi both became very, very concerned about Dr. Zarnik's low level of contribution, and as a result, they had a talk with him. They wanted to get out of the office because, remember, Illumina was sort of camping out in CW's space. So you had people who were employed by CW Group in the suite, and there may have been another company sharing space as well. So mindful of Dr. Zarnik's privacy and company privacy, Dr. Stulpnagel and Dr. Chi asked Tony Zarnik to take a walk with them outside the offices. They talked to him about his low level of contribution and expressed concern. It wasn't a discussion you're going to hear. The evidence is going to show you. It wasn't a discussion in which they said, "We're working so much harder." It was a discussion in which they said, We just don't think your level of contribution is consistent with someone at your level. And we've got new people coming in, and we all need to really set a good example. Because for the new folks coming on board, we're going to ask them all to work very, very hard, long hours. In this discussion, Dr. Zarnik assured Dr. Stulpnagel and Chi, once the company moved to its own space, he would be productive. Why would he link it to the company's move to its own space? Remember, during the Cardiff days, they're sort of squatting in CW's space. They were working out of tiny offices, but they knew at that point in August that within a month, they would be moving to their own facility, have much more space, and they would have laboratory facilities where scientists could begin doing experiments. So Drs. Chi and Stulpnagel very much hoped that Dr. Zarnik would make good on his promise and be engaged and be contributory and work hard once they moved to their new space. The company moved in September of 1998 to space on Town Center Drive with laboratories. And unfortunately, the evidence is going to show that Dr. Zarnik's work ethic and his contribution did not increase at that time. He didn't begin working particularly harder or longer. He didn't particularly contribute to the development of experiments. He did do some things, though, that I think the evidence is going to show were very helpful to building some morale and team building at Illumina. He took other employees out to lunch, sometimes footing the bill for the entire group. At the time, we were a small company, sometimes 10 employees or fewer, but that's a generous gesture. Dr. Zarnik also would host a regular popcorn get-together in the company's kitchen at the end of the day and encouraged people to come down, share popcorn, and talk. He bought some radio-controlled boats and on Fridays would encourage the employees to all come outside at 5 o'clock and race the boats. And these aren't negative things. They are team-building. These are morale-building activities. And yet, they aren't the kind of high-level scientific and business contributions that Illumina was expecting for Dr. Zarnik to make to the company, and for which they were paying him a salary of $185,000 a year. In fact, Dr. Zarnik was the highest compensated employee at Illumina at the time. He was paid more than Dr. Stulpnagel. He was paid more than Dr. Chi. And the evidence is going to show that the contributions that he was making were absolutely insufficient in comparison with the position he held and the level of compensation he was receiving. Now, one point I do want to make is that Mr. Pantone mentioned Dr. Zarnik's role as a founder. I have to say that the term founder is not legally defined. There are a number of people who arguably are founders in this company. Mr. Pantone identified Dr. Zarnik, Dr. Stulpnagel, and Dr. Chi as founders, and at a later point he identified Larry Bach from CW Group as an investor/founder. But the evidence is going to show there were a number of other people who were founders, most notably David Walt, the scientist whose technology Illumina is based on, and others. The founder status is not something that is legally significant. You are not going to hear any evidence that somebody who is a founder has a right of entitlement any greater than an early employee. Now, the next entry on the timeline is November of 1998, and I really have to focus upon this because this is a talk Dr. Stulpnagel had with Tony Zarnik. Tony characterized it as a talk not about Tony Zarnik's performance, but about Illumina's performance as a whole, and Illumina not achieving its research goals as a whole. And Mr. Pantone submitted to you the evidence is going to show that this was not, absolutely not, a discussion that John had with Tony specifically about Tony's performance. Well, you are going to hear some contrary evidence. You are going to hear evidence that is going to show that Tony Zarnik himself has described that meeting with John Stulpnagel as a scolding. That Tony Zarnik described that meeting as a meeting in which John Stulpnagel sat him down, closed the door, and told him that his efforts, Tony Zarnik's efforts, and the results of his efforts were insufficient and disappointing. That's the evidence that you are going to hear. And so it is our position that November 1998 discussion absolutely was a performance counseling. No question about it.
We're going to have a break in here somewhere, counsel.
At 4 o'clock?
Yes.
I think we may as well break for today. Thank you for your attention today.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll take our evening recess at this time. We'll be in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Please, before you leave, fill in the forms that the bailiff has passed out. Hand it to the bailiff on the way out. So we'll be in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Please be here promptly at that time because we can't start. We expect to start right at 9 a.m. We can't start until all of you are here, so please be here promptly at 9. Remember, do not form or express any opinions about the case. Do not discuss the case amongst yourselves or with anyone else. We'll be in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Have a pleasant evening. Leave your notepads on your chairs. They'll be there for you when you return tomorrow morning. Record will indicate all the jurors are present, counsel, and the parties present. When we left off yesterday, Ms. Kearns, you were in the process of giving your opening statement. You want to continue at this time?
Yes, of course. Good morning, everyone. I want to thank you for your attention yesterday and apologize that, just given the schedule that we have, that my opening was broken up. But I'm sure that you all preferred to go home at 4 o'clock rather than stay for another hour. So I'll resume this morning. I was thinking last evening one question that may have been created by some of my remarks yesterday is if Dr. Zarnik lacked the drive, the energy, motivation that I believe the evidence is going to show was the case, you may be wondering why did Illumina hire him in the first place? Why did Dr. Stulpnagel choose him to become the CSO? What you're going to hear in this case is evidence that's going to show that during the process in which Dr. Stulpnagel and Dr. Zarnik were negotiating for Dr. Zarnik to join the company, Dr. Zarnik assured Dr. Stulpnagel that he would be, and I'm quoting, Illumina's hardest working employee. You'll hear evidence that Dr. Zarnik gave Dr. Stulpnagel examples of how he used to keep a sleeping bag in his office when he was a professor at Ohio State University so that he could pull all-nighters if need be. So what you're going to hear is evidence showing that at the time that Dr. Stulpnagel was considering bringing Dr. Zarnik on board, he was getting a lot of reassurance from Dr. Zarnik that he was going to be fully engaged, working extremely hard. In fact, he'd be the hardest working employee. I left off on our timeline with a discussion of the November 1998 private meeting between Dr. Stulpnagel and Tony Zarnik, in which Dr. Zarnik's poor performance to date had been discussed. Remember, this wasn't the first performance counseling meeting, it was the second. The first one occurred in Cardiff, when Mark Chi and Dr. Stulpnagel took Tony Zarnik outside the office to express concerns about his low productivity and low contribution level. So the evidence, as I said yesterday, is going to show very clearly that the November 1998 meeting between John Stulpnagel and Tony Zarnik was not a meeting in which Dr. Stulpnagel was only expressing his concerns about Illumina's progress or Illumina's productivity towards its research and development goals. This was a very Tony Zarnik-specific meeting, and you will see in evidence the handwritten notes that John Stulpnagel made in preparation for this meeting. A list of pros and cons, or positives and negatives. And these are all Tony Zarnik-specific. These are not Illumina-specific. Now, the evidence is also going to show an important point. It's a small piece of the case, but it's a very important element here. We've got evidence that's going to show that in August, Dr. Zarnik was counseled about his productivity, contribution, his work ethic, that this happened again in November of 1998, and the evidence is going to show that in early 1999, in the first quarter of 1999, Dr. Zarnik consults with an attorney about his employment at Illumina. Now, this is important to remember because what we have here is evidence that Dr. Zarnik is consulting with an attorney in early 1999, Q1. In other words, it's before April. It's before he has his breakdown, and it's before he discloses he has depression. Before any of that happens, he's consulting with an attorney about his employment at Illumina. And we believe that the evidence is going to show that the reason he was consulting with an attorney at that point is he knew he was in trouble. He'd had two performance counselings already, and he knew that he was having some problems at Illumina, and that's why he consulted an attorney. Now, looking at our timeline, we have my first entry in 1999 is a late March entry. Zarnik's walk with Chi, where he offers to resign as CSO. A few days before the April 6, 1999 breakdown, Dr. Tony Zarnik asked Mark Chi, who was one of the other founders, one of the other senior scientists, he asked Mark Chi to take a walk around the block outside the facilities, and during that walk with Dr. Mark Chi, Tony Zarnik expressed to Dr. Chi a concern that he wasn't sure he was the right person to be the CSO of the company. He wasn't sure he was doing a good job of it, and he offered to Dr. Chi the CSO position. He, in essence, said to Dr. Chi, "Mark, if you'd like to become the CSO, I'll step down. You can be the CSO." And this is the first occasion on which Dr. Zarnik formally offered to step down as CSO. Dr. Chi, from whom you'll hear in testimony in this case, was a little taken aback by this. He, too, had had concerns about Tony Zarnik's performance, but he tried to buck up Dr. Zarnik to give him some reinforcement and reassurance. He told Dr. Zarnik he didn't want to take over the CSO position, and nothing more was said about that at that time. A couple of days later, April 6, 1999, is the date on which Dr. Zarnik had his breakdown at work. Now, Mr. Pantone in his opening statement described this event, and one of the things that's important to remember about trials is there are two sides to every story. People remember events very differently. And I've heard from Mr. Pantone and from Dr. Zarnik himself in deposition what their recollection of the event is. We believe the evidence is going to show a very different situation than the one which has been described to you by plaintiff's counsel. We believe the evidence is going to show, first of all, that this grant application assignment was given to Dr. Zarnik in November of 1998, at or about the time that John Stulpnagel counseled him about his poor performance, his low productivity, his lack of personal accountability. Now, writing grants is something that Dr. Zarnik had significant experience with. Dr. Zarnik, as I'm sure you'll hear when he takes the stand and testifies on direct, was a university professor for a number of years. And as a university professor, he wrote a number of grant applications. These are applications to the government or other funding entities. And essentially, you say, "I've got a great research project. Here is the idea. Here's what I intend to do. Here's the list of people I intend, or here are the positions of types of people I intend to have work on the project. And here's what it's going to cost." The point of a grant application is to try to get funding so that you can do the research project. So what the evidence is going to show is that Tony Zarnik had quite a bit of experience writing these grant applications. They are competitive. There are a number of researchers competing for the same pot of money. Not all of them are successful, but you've got to write a good grant application to even have a shot at getting that money. So the assignment in November of 1998 to Tony Zarnik of a grant application task was not something that was out of the realm of reasonableness. It's not something he hadn't done before. He hadn't done it at Illumina before, although Mark Chi had submitted and written a number of grant applications. But in November of 1998, John Stulpnagel wanted to give Tony Zarnik a task for which he'd assumed personal responsibility, and the writing of this grant seemed like a good task. It's something he'd done before, and more importantly, it was a big grant. If the grant had been awarded, it would have been very significant in terms of the money that could have supported Illumina's research program. So Dr. Zarnik had this grant assignment in November of 1998. He took a special out-of-town seminar for the purpose of learning how to best write the grant for this particular funding group, NIST. He also had taken several days immediately before April 6, 1999. He'd taken several days out of the office from Illumina to work on the grant at home so that he could work on it without distraction. What happened on April 6, 1999 is Dr. Zarnik came into the office, and the evidence is going to show that he asked for a meeting with John Stulpnagel and Mark Chi behind closed doors. They go into the office, the door is closed, and the evidence is going to show that Dr. Zarnik started the discussion very matter-of-factly by simply saying, "I'm not going to be able to finish the grant." Now, bear in mind, the grant deadline was a matter of days away, and Dr. Zarnik had had this assignment on his plate for almost 5 months. Dr. Stulpnagel did express some disappointment, frustration, didn't understand why Dr. Zarnik wasn't going to be able to complete this grant, and questioned him, you know, why can't you finish this? At which point the evidence is going to show Dr. Zarnik broke down and began crying. Now, I have to point out that there are going to be two absolutely opposite versions here. According to the plaintiff's version, Dr. Zarnik came into the meeting and dissolved into tears immediately. In fact, we believe the evidence is going to show that he came in, he matter-of-factly said he can't finish the grant, Dr. Stulpnagel was expressing frustration and disbelief, and at that point, Dr. Zarnik broke down. We believe the evidence is going to show as soon as Dr. Zarnik broke down, Dr. Stulpnagel stopped all inquiry about why he couldn't do it, what the reasons were, and became very concerned for Dr. Zarnik's welfare. He told Dr. Zarnik the most important thing for him to do was to take care of himself, to go home, to get some rest, to feel better. And during this meeting, when Dr. Zarnik is admittedly very emotional, breaking down, he told Dr. Stulpnagel and Dr. Chi that perhaps he should leave the company. Now, you heard Mr. Pantone say yesterday that it was John Stulpnagel who said something to Tony Zarnik, like, if the job is too tough for you, maybe you should just leave. But in fact, we believe the evidence is going to show that in his emotional state, Dr. Zarnik said, if you want me to, I'll leave the company. I'll resign. I'll step down as CSO. He did express the desire to continue working at Illumina, but also said that if the other two felt it was in the company's best interests, he would step down or leave the company entirely. Now, our next entry is April 8th, 1999. Dr. Zarnik returns to work on that day, as Mr. Pantone mentioned, after self-medicating with Dexedrine at home. He comes to work, and immediately upon arriving, he asks for a closed-door meeting with Dr. Stulpnagel and Rich Pytalewski. Mark Chi was not on site that day, otherwise, presumably, he would have been included as well. But now that Dr. Zarnik was back, he wanted to meet with his other senior managers and give a little bit of explanation about what had happened 2 days earlier. Because remember, the evidence is actually uncontroverted that in the meeting on April 6th, Dr. Zarnik did break down. He did become emotional. But he didn't tell anyone at that time what was wrong. He didn't say he suffered from depression. So on April 8th, during this meeting with Dr. Stulpnagel and Rich Pytalewski, at that point, Dr. Zarnik explained that he suffered from depression, that he'd had the condition for over 10 years, that he found his condition to be very well controlled by medication, and that some short period of time prior to April, he had changed medications, and that the medication to which he changed simply wasn't as good as the one he used to take. It wasn't controlling his depression, and he spiraled into a depression. He then told Dr. Stulpnagel and Mr. Pytalewski he now had gone to his doctor and he was going to resume his earlier medication regimen, the one that had controlled his depression well, that he was feeling better, that he was capable of resuming work immediately, and that was about it. And Rich Pytalewski said, let's go back to work. And everyone went back to work. Incidentally, the evidence is going to show that Dr. Zarnik asked John Stulpnagel to brief Mark Chi, to tell him what had happened, because Mark Chi, of course, had been in the prior meeting where Dr. Zarnik broke down. Now, one of the things on the plaintiff's timeline was the fact that on April 11th, 1999, Stulpnagel and Chi discussed replacing Zarnik as CSO. Lawyers, myself included, do tend to put our own spin on words. It's not disputed that there was a discussion on April 11th, 1999. But given what the evidence is going to show, what we have is this. We have Dr. Zarnik walking around with Mark Chi in late March 1999 saying, I'm not sure I'm doing a good job. I'm not sure I'm the right person to be CSO. Do you want the position? I'm willing to step down. We then have that same offer repeated during the breakdown on April 6th to Dr. Stulpnagel and Chi. You know, if you want me to leave, I'll leave. If you want me to step down, I'll step down. So on April 11th, Dr. Stulpnagel and Dr. Chi happened to be traveling out of town for a business meeting, and during this meeting, they discussed the fact that Dr. Zarnik had twice in the last month offered to step down as CSO. And they were not discussing it, the evidence is going to show. They weren't discussing it as a concept that they were suggesting. They were discussing how they felt about Dr. Zarnik's offer made twice in the last few days to step down. What Dr. Stulpnagel and Dr. Chi concluded is that although they had some concerns about Dr. Zarnik's abilities to really be an effective CSO and lead the company, they also noted that it didn't make sense for Dr. Chi to assume the CSO role because they needed somebody who was more cross-functional. And also, Dr. Chi had a tremendous amount of scientific experiments he was overseeing. And they also determined that since they didn't have an identified candidate to step into that role, it didn't make sense for Dr. Zarnik to step down. Now, the next entry that we have on our timeline is April 23, 1999. Within a matter of weeks after his breakdown, Dr. Zarnik began seeing a psychiatrist here in town named Alan Malinger. He saw Dr. Malinger roughly weekly, and the reason I mention Dr. Malinger is because you are going to hear from him in this case. The important aspect of Dr. Malinger's testimony, which I'd like to ask you to remember when you hear from him, is this. Dr. Malinger is somebody who was seeing Tony Zarnik just about every single week from April 23rd through a period of 9 months to a year. During these treatment sessions, Dr. Zarnik told Dr. Malinger a number of things about what was going on with him at work. It's a typical counseling session. Remember, these are the statements that Tony Zarnik was making to his psychiatrist at the time of the events at Illumina. And what you're going to see is the evidence is going to show that Dr. Zarnik clearly had a grudge against John Stulpnagel. But he wasn't telling Dr. Malinger that he was being excluded. He wasn't telling Dr. Malinger that he was being discriminated against. He didn't talk to Dr. Malinger about any whistleblowing issue. And essentially what we have is notes that show that by May, and you'll see those notes, Dr. Zarnik was telling Dr. Malinger that things were much better at work, that things between him and John Stulpnagel were going much more smoothly. And he also recounted, or told Dr. Malinger, that he and John Stulpnagel had had a very rocky working relationship. And there's a statement in the early treatment notes that says that his boss, John Stulpnagel, had been unhappy with his performance for the last 6 months. And if you go back 6 months from the first treatment notes, it puts you squarely in the November 1998 timeframe, which is when John Stulpnagel had his first very pointed sit-down meeting with Dr. Zarnik to go over the positives he contributed, but also the negative things he needed to work on. It's important to remember that these are statements made by Dr. Zarnik to his psychiatrist at the time of the events. Although there may be an attempt to recharacterize them now that we're in a lawsuit, or there may be a change in the way that Dr. Zarnik now remembers the events, the fact is Dr. Malinger's notes reflect what Dr. Zarnik said about what was going on in his life at the time. Now, the evidence is going to show that as the organization grew, Dr. Stulpnagel realized that the company needed more depth in its senior management team. In particular, he even concluded a stronger CEO was going to be needed. Now remember, Dr. Stulpnagel at the time was the acting CEO, but he concluded that for the good of the company, it was going to be better to find somebody who had more experience, more depth, preferably somebody who had already had experience with taking a company public, which John Stulpnagel did not. So he began looking for a new candidate, and he happened to be aware of Jay Flatley, because there had been some business dealings, or I should say business negotiation meetings, between Jay Flatley when he was with a company called Molecular Dynamics and Illumina. There might have been a collaboration that would have worked between the two companies, and Dr. Stulpnagel was aware Mr. Flatley might be available. Molecular Dynamics, which was Jay Flatley's earlier company, had been acquired by another corporation, and it was well known in the industry that Mr. Flatley had a one-year transition contract. He was obligated to remain on board with what had been Molecular Dynamics for a year to help the transition team take over the company. But he was going to be, as we say, loose in the socket at the end of a year, and he'd be looking for another exciting opportunity. As a result, Dr. Stulpnagel spearheaded an effort to speak with Jay Flatley about his interest in coming on board as Illumina's new CEO. And in fact, the entire senior management team, including Dr. Tony Zarnik, interviewed and approved of Mr. Flatley. Mr. Flatley actually joined Illumina as its new CEO in October of 1999. Now, one point I missed is the end of April 1999 entry. Stulpnagel counseled Zarnik on a Saturday about performance. This was the entry which appeared on the plaintiff's timeline as having occurred May 29th, 1999. Again, people remember events differently. Both Dr. Zarnik and Dr. Stulpnagel remember this discussion as having taken place on a Saturday when they were both at the office. But Dr. Stulpnagel specifically remembers that it was toward the end of April. They were in the office on a Saturday. Dr. Zarnik has described this or characterized this meeting as a talk about putting personal differences aside. And in fact, we believe the evidence will show that this was a talk, again, about performance and Dr. Zarnik's need to step it up and start contributing. Now, what we have from April through October is no change in Dr. Zarnik's responsibilities, no change in what it is he was included in, what it is he was asked to do. And then we have, as I mentioned, Jay Flatley coming on board in November as the new CEO. Now, a couple of points to make here is that Dr. Zarnik contacted Jay Flatley in a somewhat unusual way. He knew that Jay Flatley was coming on board as the new CEO. On September 24, 1999, well before Jay Flatley was actually beginning at Illumina, Tony Zarnik emails Jay Flatley at home, asking for a special schedule to allow him to go swimming in the middle of the workday. And whether or not that's an appropriate request, it struck Mr. Flatley as strange. It struck him as something that certainly could have waited until he was at Illumina to discuss, and it was a little bit of a red flag. Another issue to remember is that on the same date, September 24th, 1999, this is a date on which Jay Flatley, knowing that he was coming on board as CEO in less than a month, traveled to San Diego and met one-on-one with each of the individual senior managers, including Tony Zarnik. So I bring that point to your attention because there was a statement by Mr. Pantone that the evidence is going to show that after Jay Flatley came on board, he didn't meet with Dr. Zarnik as CSO. He didn't use him as CSO. In fact, on September 24th, there were these one-on-one meetings where Jay met with each of the people who would be on his senior management team and learned what was going on, what they had going. Now, contrary to Dr. Zarnik's beliefs, John Stulpnagel did not brief Jay Flatley about performance issues, about disability issues. John Stulpnagel truly did allow Jay Flatley to form his own impressions. And part of the reason for this, and you'll hear this from Dr. Stulpnagel directly, to some degree, Tony Zarnik was a reflection upon him in that he'd hired Tony Zarnik, he'd managed Tony Zarnik. He hadn't been able to draw out of Tony Zarnik the type of performance that he thought he should have. And so to some degree, John Stulpnagel will admit he was a little embarrassed about Tony Zarnik's performance under his leadership. And he was also very hopeful. He was hopeful, although perhaps not convinced, but hopeful that a new, more experienced CEO might be able to pull out of Tony Zarnik the kind of dedication and performance that he, John Stulpnagel, had not been able to do. So for those reasons, he didn't brief Mr. Flatley about any issues relating to Tony Zarnik, nor did he brief Mr. Flatley about any issues relating to Rich Pytelewski, with whom Dr. Stulpnagel also had some performance concerns. Now, the next entry that we have here is November 22nd, 1999. This is very shortly after Jay Flatley came on board as CEO. As I said, Dr. Stulpnagel wanted for Mr. Flatley to form his own impressions of Tony Zarnik. Within a very short period of time, Jay Flatley did indeed form some very strong impressions of Dr. Zarnik and his performance. On November 22, 1999, they had an off-site strategic meeting. At the time, Jay Flatley was living in a temporary apartment very close to Illumina's facilities, and he had his senior managers, Tony Zarnik, Rich Pytelewski, John Stulpnagel, Mark Chi, join him in the apartment for an all-day strategic meeting. Dr. Zarnik made a very poor impression on Jay Flatley during this meeting. He came ill-prepared. Each senior manager had been assigned a module or more than one module of a topic for discussion and preparation, and to lead a discussion. The evidence is going to show that Dr. Zarnik came very ill-prepared and basically contributed very little in terms of strategic contribution. The next thing that occurred that made a very negative impression upon Jay Flatley is the January 2000 Scientific Advisory Board meeting. Now let me talk a little bit about what a scientific advisory board is. A scientific advisory board for a company like Illumina is a group of sort of hand-picked scientists from around the world. And the purpose of having a scientific advisory board is to have some very highly regarded, world-renowned scientists who spend some time each year getting together, taking a look at Illumina's technology, brainstorming with us, offering us constructive criticism. Basically, it's a form of having some very esteemed scientists who are outside the company take a role in evaluating our technology and helping us to make it better. These people are very highly qualified. They come from many places throughout the world, and it's expensive. When we have a scientific advisory board meeting, Illumina flies these people in, puts them up in hotels, does some entertainment of them, and these meetings are usually pretty lean. They are usually a 1 or 2 day meeting, typically one day, and it's important that time be used productively. Remember, the people who are on the scientific advisory board are busy, successful people. They are taking time out of their schedules to take time and add value to Illumina. So it's important these meetings be well run, well organized, and they actually accomplish something. Now, Dr. Zarnik, as chief scientific officer, was responsible for spearheading the scientific advisory board meetings. The January 2000 scientific advisory board meeting is the first one which Dr. Zarnik had run and which Jay Flatley observed. It was, you will hear evidence in this case, that Dr. Zarnik ran this meeting in a very disorganized and, frankly, amateurish manner. It was an embarrassment to the company. And Mr. Flatley shortly after that got feedback from one of the scientific advisory board members, David Walt, who was very disappointed in Dr. Zarnik's performance at this meeting. Now remember, Dr. Walt is also a founder. He's the person whose technology, Illumina's technology, is based upon. And he was a scientific advisory board member, and he was at this meeting. After the meeting, the evidence is going to show that Dr. David Walt had a discussion with Jay Flatley in which he expressed grave concerns about Dr. Zarnik's performance at that scientific advisory board meeting and also expressed a concern to Jay Flatley that Tony Zarnik just didn't seem engaged. He didn't seem interested. And Dr. Walt was questioning whether Dr. Zarnik even had a desire to continue his affiliation with Illumina. As a result, Dr. Walt asked Jay Flatley whether it made sense for him to have breakfast with Tony Zarnik to sort of discuss these issues. Dr. Walt had known Tony Zarnik for a while, and Jay Flatley said, by all means, go ahead, please do that. The evidence is going to show that Dr. Walt, in fact, did have that breakfast meeting with Tony Zarnik, and the evidence is going to show that his impression is that Tony Zarnik said yes, he still wanted to be with Illumina. And it was Dr. Walt's belief that Tony Zarnik rationalized all of his shortcomings, but just still did not seem engaged. He didn't have that fire in the belly, as they say. So as a result of this, Dr. Zarnik's performance had to be addressed, and Jay Flatley made a determination that he would ask Dr. Zarnik to have a private dinner, and this dinner occurred on February 7th, 2000. Now, the initial intention on Mr. Flatley's part was to have a very tough discussion with Tony Zarnik about his poor performance. Another performance issue which I neglected to mention, which occurred again right around the time of the dinner, is that there was a collaboration between Illumina and Chevron. There had been a contact by a Chevron employee who was spearheading the project. It was a joint project between Chevron and Illumina. Tony Zarnik was the lead on Illumina's side, and this other individual was the lead on Chevron's side. There was a meeting at Illumina where the Chevron representatives were conferring or meeting with their Illumina counterparts, but after the general meeting was over, the Chevron lead representative asked to have a private one-on-one with Jay Flatley, and behind closed doors, the Chevron representative told Jay Flatley that he was very disappointed in the way that Tony Czarnik was leading up the effort on behalf of Illumina, that he asked for certain things to be done which weren't done or which weren't done in a timely manner. So bear in mind, by the time Jay Flatley has dinner with Tony Czarnik on February 7th, there are issues relating to his performance at the Scientific Advisory Board meeting. There are issues relating to how he performed at the off-site strategic meeting. There are customer or collaborator complaints about his contributions. Now, during the dinner on February 7th, Jay Flatley intended to address these issues, but they started talking and the conversation veered toward the fact that the company might be going public. So there was some discussion between Mr. Flatley and Dr. Czarnik about the fact that the company might be going public. At this point, Tony Czarnik tells Jay Flatley in so many words, "I've offered before to step down as CSO, and if you think it's in the company's best interest, particularly if we're going public, I'll step down as CSO." This was, in fact, a big relief to Jay Flatley because it no longer required him to go through point by point and discuss the ways in which Dr. Czarnik was failing. But rather, Dr. Czarnik was again renewing his offer to resign and step down as CSO. And Dr. Czarnik proposed a different role for himself. He said, "I'll become a research fellow." He said a research fellow is a very high-level scientific position where essentially the person just focuses on doing experiments and doing science. They don't have to manage or supervise other people. They don't have to make contributions to business strategy. They just do pure science. And this sounded very attractive to Jay Flatley. It essentially solved his problem of having a CSO whose performance needed to improve dramatically. But the problem is he didn't have a candidate yet. Now, Tony Pantone said to you that Jay Flatley contacted David Barker, someone with whom he worked at Molecular Dynamics. And this is true. Dr. Barker was a proven, strong lead scientist. Jay Flatley had worked with him for a number of years, and Jay Flatley knew, certainly by January, that he had a weak CSO. He did call David Barker on or about February 4th, 2000, and inquired of David whether he might have an interest. He did not offer him a position. He just felt him out. Do you have an interest? Might you be interested in coming on board? One of the reasons that Jay Flatley only could see if there was some interest is because he was supposedly under a no-hire contract with his former company, not to hire people from that company for a year. And he may have been prepared, you'll hear from Mr. Flatley, he may have been prepared to wait a full year to bring David Barker on board if that was the intention. But at this point, he was just soliciting a statement from Dr. Barker of whether there's any interest whatsoever. So by the time of the dinner, he wasn't sure if he could hire David Barker, even if David Barker wanted to come on board. But David Barker did indicate he was interested. Jay Flatley then began a process of communication with his former employer to find out whether they would allow him to hire David Barker. And ultimately, the decision of the other company was that they would allow Jay Flatley to hire David Barker. Now, at the close of the Daily's dinner, Jay Flatley did not tell Tony Czarnik he would be replaced as CSO. He told him, "I will consider your proposal. I need to think about it." He needed to think about it, and frankly, he needed to see whether or not he could find another CSO candidate to come on board. He had David Barker in mind, but he didn't know he could hire him. And a few weeks later, or a week or two later, Dr. Czarnik was in the office and Jay Flatley met with him and told him, "I am going to take you up on your offer. I'm going to have you step down as CSO and become a research fellow." And at this time, Mr. Flatley told Tony Czarnik since his job duties would be different and he would no longer be managing people, he was going to reduce his salary from $185,000 a year, which is what he had been earning as CSO, to $165,000 a year. It's about a 10% reduction. He also told Tony Czarnik that he was going to think about reducing his stock vesting. And at this initial discussion of this concept, Tony Czarnik did not object to either aspect of it. Now, shortly thereafter, Tony Czarnik did object to a reduction in his stock, and Jay Flatley did confer with his attorneys. He was working with a different firm than mine at the time. And he did then communicate back to Tony Czarnik, I'm told by my attorneys that I can't reduce your stock unless you agree to it. Will you agree to it? Tony Czarnik said, no, I won't, so the stock was never reduced. So Tony Czarnik has been told that his offer to become a research fellow is being accepted, and Tony Czarnik announces to the company by way of email that he decided to step down as CSO and become a research fellow. And in that email, he acknowledges his strengths are scientific and not so much on the business end. Although things appeared to be moving along well, shortly after his public announcement that he was becoming the research fellow, Tony Czarnik went in to speak privately with Jay Flatley, and he told Jay Flatley, I just can't do this. I want to leave. I want to leave immediately, and I want severance. I want severance, and I want to take all of my stock. Now remember, you're going to hear evidence about the stock grants in this case, and in essence, when Tony Czarnik came on board, he was given the opportunity to purchase 400,000 shares of Illumina stock at a penny a share. So an investment, if you will, of $4,000. The scheme or the structure of the stock plan is that Tony Czarnik had to be employed for a full year to have ownership rights in any of that stock. Technically speaking, he bought it for a penny a share, but the company at all times had a right to buy it back at a penny a share. After 1 year, Tony Czarnik had vested, and I use that term loosely because it's actually a diminishing right of repurchase, but the bottom line is after 1 year, as to one-fifth of that stock, or 80,000 shares, Tony Czarnik owned those 80,000 shares and they could not be bought back by the company. But the remaining 320,000 shares were still subject to a right of repurchase by the company if Tony left the company for any reason, regardless of whether the company fired him or he quit. And then, after he cleared the one-year cliff, Tony Czarnik began vesting in shares monthly at the rate of about 6,666.67 shares per month. So the idea is that at the end of 5 years, he would own all 400,000 shares free and clear, but the ownership accrued over time. So what Tony Czarnik was proposing to Jay Flatley is he wanted to resign, he wanted to leave immediately, and he wanted to have full ownership right to all of his stock, all 400,000 shares. And Mr. Flatley was rather taken aback by this. The evidence is going to show that he communicated to Tony Czarnik that the company generally didn't pay severance to people who quit. Now, Mr. Flatley had recently terminated or advised Mr. Pytelewski of his intention to terminate his employment, and this again was a company-initiated action. But Mr. Pytelewski and Mr. Flatley worked out a separation agreement and a severance plan. So in light of that, Mr. Flatley, although Tony Czarnik was resigning, Mr. Flatley was prepared to do something for him that would be fair, equitable, and fairly consistent with whatever it was he was giving Mr. Pytelewski. But that wasn't enough for Dr. Czarnik. And so there began in the spring of 2000, beginning in March, continuing into April, a back-and-forth negotiation of what it is the company would be willing to give Tony Czarnik in severance. And Tony Czarnik continued to demand a fairly rich package, and finally an impasse was reached. Now, one of the things to remember is that Dr. Czarnik had resigned. The initial mindset on the part of Jay Flatley is, given the fact that he's resigned and says he doesn't want to be here, he's not going to be here. So most of the energies were trying to reach an agreement on the severance package. But those negotiations broke down, and so it became necessary to actually then shift focus and start focusing upon what is it that Tony Czarnik is going to do as a research fellow. During this time that they were negotiating, Dr. Czarnik knew that the previous offer of research fellow was going to be at a salary of $165,000 a year. He knew his stock couldn't unilaterally be changed. On April 4, 2000, the actual change in position was in effect. Dr. Czarnik, as of that date, was a research fellow, was not CSO. On the same date, even though he had known for quite some time that it was going to be at a lower salary, Dr. Czarnik sent Jay Flatley an email claiming that the terms of his original contract, meaning his CSO position, had been changed in a manner that he considered discriminatory. He also sent Jay Flatley an email in which he then went beyond simply using the word discriminatory and talked about discrimination based on a medical condition. The evidence is going to show when Jay Flatley got this email, he had no idea what Tony Zarnik was talking about. And at that point, he went to John Stulpnagel and said, "Do you know what he's talking about? What medical condition?" At that point, and never before, but at this point for the very first time, John Stulpnagel told Jay Flatley about Tony Zarnik's April 1999 breakdown and history of depression. Now, after the severance negotiations broke down, they started moving forward with an attempt to develop goals for the research fellow position. Tony Zarnik was asked to go ahead and develop an initial draft of goals and to show them to David Barker. He did so, and then he provided them to Jay Flatley. Jay Flatley then conferred with David Barker, Mark Chi, and John Stulpnagel about the goals that Tony Zarnik had developed. Now you'll see those goals. In fact, Mr. Pantone put up the Tony Zarnik goals and then the final goals. And the evidence is going to show that the Tony Zarnik proposed goals were all soft goals. They were not measurable. They were not specific. They were not action-oriented. They were not realistic. And they weren't time-dated. And so there's an acronym, SMART, S-M-A-R-T, which means specific, measurable, action-oriented, realistic, and time-dated. And these are the kind of goals that Illumina wants to give to its employees. As a result, there was a refinement in Tony Zarnik's goals. Rather than giving him as a goal things like mentor scientists, how do you measure mentor scientists? He was given a set of SMART goals. The binary oligote goal, which Mr. Pantone referred to, was a project that Tony Zarnik had proposed sometime earlier, so they were giving him as a goal one of his own proposed projects to perform. Now, I have to comment briefly upon the fact, in going through the goals, Mr. Pantone made the point that Dr. Zarnik was being asked to do things that had never been done in the company before. Well, that's the point of a research and development program. You do new things. You make new discoveries. You create new science. You don't just replicate and do over that which you've done before. You do something new, and that's what he was being asked to do. Mr. Pantone focused upon the numbers of beads that Dr. Zarnik was supposed to demonstrate feasibility of decoding. I won't dwell on it now, but let me just put this out there. There is a huge difference between an experiment that demonstrates feasibility of decoding a great number of beads and an experiment which actually decodes a great number of beads. You'll hear more about that from our scientists, but the bottom line is an experiment that simply demonstrates feasibility is what we call a proof-of-principle experiment. It is less specific. It is less rigorous. It simply demonstrates that, at a high level of complexity, when you've got a lot of different bead types, the concept works. On the other hand, an actual decoding of, 5,000 bead types means that you have actually decoded the DNA on each of those bead types. That's not the kind of experiment that Tony Zarnik was being asked to do. He was being asked to do the easier type of experiment, which was to demonstrate feasibility. So now we get to the May timeframe. Mr. Flatley had regular scheduled meetings, or he had a regularly scheduled meeting with Tony Zarnik for May 18th, 2000. And it was understood by both of them that the purpose of this May 18 meeting was for Jay Flatley to assign Tony Zarnik his goals as research fellow, to sit down and discuss them and then understand them. However, Tony Zarnik elected on that day to go to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing and to file a charge against Illumina for disability discrimination. As a result, he missed his meeting with Jay Flatley, didn't phone Jay Flatley from the DFEH to say he was running late and wouldn't be there, but he missed the meeting. So the following day, when he was in the office, Jay Flatley and Tony Zarnik did meet, and Tony Zarnik was given his goals. I point that out because Jay Flatley was ready, willing, and able to assign those goals on May 18th, but it was Tony Zarnik who elected not to be in the office and not to be available to get his goals. The evidence is going to show that any suggestion that Jay Flatley developed and gave goals on May 19th to retaliate for Tony Czarnik having gone to the DFEH is just not supported at all. He was ready to give these goals on May 18th. We then have a situation in which, as of May 19th, 2000, Dr. Czarnik has some specific, measurable goals that he needs to start working on. Mr. Flatley schedules regular meetings with him to discuss his progress toward these goals. You'll hear evidence that in one of the early meetings, Dr. Czarnik shows up at the meeting empty-handed, nothing to show for his efforts, and at the closure of the meeting, asks Mr. Flatley, "Can I have another copy of my goals?" We believe the evidence is going to show that from the time the goals were assigned to Dr. Czarnik, he never took them seriously. He never made a serious effort to work toward these goals, and ultimately that led to his termination. He wasn't even trying. We have the July 2000 IPO roadshow. Now, during this period of time, Jay Flatley was out of the office on the roadshow. Incidentally, although there was a suggestion made by Mr. Pantone that it would have been more appropriate to have Tony Czarnik reporting to David Barker, I also have to say the evidence is going to show that David Barker was on the roadshow during the entire same month of July. Now, why is this that Jay Flatley had Tony Czarnik report to him rather than David Barker? Well, the evidence is going to show, first of all, that initially Tony Czarnik had resigned, so there was no reason to transition him to David Barker since he was going to be leaving. Then, once he became research fellow, it was clear on a couple of levels. There was a discussion between David Barker and Jay Flatley about the fact that Tony Czarnik did have some performance issues that were going to need to be managed very closely. David Barker was coming in to fulfill the role previously held by Tony Czarnik, and he did not want to be viewed by Tony's former subordinates, the chemistry team, as coming in and beating up on the person who held the job before. So it was decided that Jay Flatley would manage Tony Czarnik, but the evidence is also going to show that in evaluating whether Tony was making progress toward these goals, Jay Flatley didn't make that determination on his own. He conferred with David Barker, who from a scientific perspective was able to look at what it is Dr. Czarnik had proposed, which was very little, and to tell Jay Flatley this does not represent a very good effort. Now, we talked a little about the roadshow yesterday. The roadshow is a fast and furious whirlwind tour over the course of about a month. In Illumina's roadshow, the team visited 17 different cities throughout the world, and in each city sometimes made multiple presentations to various groups about Illumina and why the company was an exciting company. Now, there was an experiment going on during the summer of 2000, which is known as the 768 decoding experiment. That's the experiment you're going to hear a lot of scientific evidence about. It's pretty interesting once our scientists start explaining it. But importantly, first of all, our scientists are going to testify that this is an experiment that was being done. It was one in a series. We started out doing 16-bead decoding experiments. We then ramped it up to the level of 128-bead decoding experiments. And in the summer of 2000, we were taking a shot at doing a 768-bead type decoding experiment. This experiment was not being done specifically for the roadshow. It was simply part of the progression of the decoding experiments. But it is true that while the roadshow team was on the roadshow, Mark Chi, who was spearheading this experiment, sent an email to the team on the roadshow and said, "Here's the latest data from the 768 decoding experiment." Now, Mr. Flatley is an experienced CEO who has taken more than one company public, and you will hear from him that once you go on your roadshow and start making presentations to investors, you keep the presentations as identical as possible from group to group to group, so each gets the same information. The 768 decode data, which was sent to the roadshow team halfway through the roadshow, was never mentioned to the roadshow audiences, never shown to them, never discussed. Now, there is some discussion about the fact that toward the very end of the roadshow, July 26th, actually, Illumina receives a letter from the vendor that sold it some of the dye that was used in the 768 decode experiment. I have to touch upon this because the evidence is going to show something very different than what Mr. Pantone suggested it would. I'm not the best person to describe the 768 decode experiment, but the bottom line is you have these beads with DNA. You have complementary strands of DNA that would find their mates that hybridize, and the complementary strands of DNA were labeled with dyes. The dye lots that we got were small. There wasn't enough dye in a single vial to do the experiment. So I believe the evidence is going to show that for each color, there were approximately 11 vials of dye used. So if you had green, red, blue, you'd have 11 vials of green, 11 vials of red, 11 vials of blue. You'd pool all the blue vials together and have a bunch of blue dye, and you'd label certain beads with blue dye. You'd pool all the green vials together and so forth. So what Mr. Pantone suggested is that the experiment resulted in us thinking that we had green dye, but we had blue dye, or something to that effect. In fact, here's what happened. We thought we were working with three distinct colors. We were working with three distinct colors. The problem is we had red, blue, green, and I'm not sure which color it is that was impaired, but think of it this way. If you've got red and you've got 11 vials of red, you've got a really pure lot of red dye. If you've got blue and you've got 11 vials of blue, you've got a really pure lot of blue dye. And then let's say in your green dye, you've got 7 vials of green, but 4 of them were blue. And you mix them all together and you think that's your green dye. Well, it is your green dye. It's not as green as it would have been if all 11 vials had been green, but it is still distinguishable from the blue dye. It is still distinguishable from the red dye. You will hear evidence from the scientists who did this experiment that will explain that although it would have been ideal for all of the dye lots to be absolutely pure, the fact that a few vials, it's not the entire lot that was mislabeled, it was just a few vials of the 11, the fact that a few of the vials of 11 were mislabeled did not mean the experiment was worthless. It didn't mean the results were invalid. It simply meant that instead of having bright red, bright blue, bright green, you had bright red, bright blue, and a green that was, you know, not quite as pure or not quite as green as you'd like, but they were still all distinguishable from one another. And you'll see the scientific data that actually shows it in the form of kind of a distribution or gathering, and you see there are three distinct clusters. So this 768 decode experiment had a problem with the dye. The problem did not impair the integrity of the experiment or make it useless. And what the evidence is going to show is that this wasn't a secret. Everyone at Illumina knew this had happened. And interestingly, Dr. Zarnik did not engage in whistleblowing activity. Now, it's Mr. Pantone's contention that Dr. Zarnik went to Mark Chi and talked about the problem with the dye and expressed some concerns about whether the 768 data was going to be shown on the roadshow. We believe the evidence is going to show that that did not occur. And in fact, we believe the evidence is going to show that the first time that Tony Zarnik raised this issue with Mark Chi was when he sent him his email hours before he suspected he was about to be terminated. The evidence is also going to show this. Mark Chi wasn't on the roadshow. David Barker was. Jay Flatley was. Tim Kish was. John Stulpnagel was. The roadshow team came back right after the IPO, or right after the roadshow, and the evidence is going to show that Tony Zarnik did not go and talk to Jay Flatley. He did not talk to John Stulpnagel, he did not talk to David Barker, and he did not talk to Tim Kish to inquire, was there some data from the 768 disclosed on the roadshow? I'm worried about that. He didn't go to talk to any of them about it. The evidence in this case is going to show, then, that after the roadshow, there were a series of meetings between Mr. Flatley and Tony Zarnik about his continued lack of performance. You will hear about those meetings. You'll see the memoranda that documented these meetings. But in short, Tony Zarnik had decided that the goals he had, he didn't like. He characterized them as unreasonable, that he didn't even make a good faith effort to even try to work on any of these goals. He became divisive. He was posting his goals above his desk and calling in other chemists saying, "Look at these, aren't these ridiculous?" He wasn't giving it a good effort. Finally, there was a scheduled meeting for September 5th, 2000. It was one of the regularly scheduled performance meetings between Dr. Zarnik and Jay Flatley, and days before this, a week before this, actually, there had been another such meeting. Tony Zarnik came to that meeting with nothing in hand, no experimental results. He had not done any experiments. And Mr. Flatley concluded at this point that he wanted to terminate Tony Zarnik's employment. He had just had it. When I say he had just had it, I mean he had been working with Tony Zarnik. He'd been meeting with him nearly weekly. He'd been giving him every opportunity to step up to the plate and give it even a little bit of effort. And yet, faced with someone who continued week after week not to give it any effort, to come to the meetings empty-handed, to sit there pretty silently, and to say, "I have nothing," Jay Flatley had to make a decision. Do I continue to dedicate company resources of $165,000 a year in salary alone to letting somebody basically not produce? And he couldn't do that. Mr. Flatley is the CEO of the company, has great responsibilities to the company, its shareholders, and to its other employees to manage the company properly. And in the face of somebody who was really not going to give it any effort, he finally made the decision he was ready to terminate Tony Zarnik's employment. So on September 5th, Tony Zarnik shows up for his scheduled meeting with Jay Flatley at about 6 p.m. But interestingly, he sends to Mark Chi this code blue email, which you will see in this case. In this email, he's inquiring whether Mark Chi ever told Jay Flatley about the problem with the 768 decode experiment. We do suggest this was an email sent for the purpose of creating some sort of paper trail supporting a whistleblower claim. If Tony Zarnik was concerned whether or not Jay Flatley knew about this, why didn't he talk to Jay Flatley about it? He was meeting with Jay Flatley virtually weekly to go over his own performance, and yet he chose not to address this with Jay Flatley. He chose to address it to Mark Chi a few hours before he knew he was going into a meeting at which he was likely to be terminated because he hadn't produced anything. In closing my opening, I guess I'd like to just remind you that the evidence will take place over the course of both Mr. Pantone's case and mine. I'd like to ask you to keep an open mind. I believe that when all is said and done, the evidence is going to support the version of facts which I've articulated to you yesterday and this morning, that this is a situation in which it was a bad fit from the beginning. And yet, Illumina gave Tony Zarnik every opportunity to succeed. And that the reason that Tony Zarnik did not succeed is he elected not to. He elected not to work hard. He elected not to work on the goals that were assigned to him. And the reason he was let go had nothing to do with his history of depression, and there was no whistleblowing.
Thank you, counsel. And that concludes the opening statements, ladies and gentlemen. Now we begin the presentation of evidence. Call your first witness, Mr. Pantone.
Your Honor, it will be a little bit of setup I need to do.
We'll take our morning recess at this time. We'll be in recess until 10:25. 10:25. Please remember the admonition not to form or express any opinions about the case, not to discuss the case. We'll be in recess until 10:25.